Welcome to White Pill Radio, the every other, usually, episode of Theology on Air, which is an outgrowth of Theology by the Pint. We are so glad that you join us. This is a kind of current events, news, headlines, articles that we look at from a Christian worldview. I like to say that it is blessed talk, but not happy talk. And this is post-apologetic, ultimately hopeful, applied theology that definitely does look at these hottest of hot stories from a Christian point of view. So we've got a lot to talk about today, so we're going to, you know, jump in relatively soon. But first, we do want you to go to theologybythepint.org to learn about upcoming events. Austin Freeman, he's going to be... Are you talking in May? Is that right?
Yeah, smash that subscribe button, y'all.
Okay, cool. But theologybythepint.org, May event, April event coming up here at First Lutheran. Anyway, check it out. See what we got. And learn about all of our leadership, like Sarah.
Ta-da!
Sarah is here. Sarah Stone, the one and only, the grand poobah of Theology by the Pint.
Indeed.
And so Austin is repping
Houston Christian University, formerly Houston Baptist University.
Now they're Christians, though.
I've heard that joke a lot.
Probably from me, because I love it.
I am the chair of the Department of Apologetics and the administrator of our Masters of Arts in Apologetics. So we are defiantly not post-apologetic, but we are the best place in the world to study cultural and imaginative apologetics. We're the intersection of theology, literature, poetry, fantasy, science fiction, all of the other cool stuff, pop culture. I'm also assistant professor of theology there, and the views expressed on this radio broadcast are not necessarily the views of Houston Christian University.
Unless you like them, and then they are.
Come and study with us.
Well, we got a lot to dig into. We have so many stories, we don't have time for them all, probably, but let's go fast and see what we can do. So, yeah. Sarah, start us
off. Here we go. Probably you guys may have seen this already, that Richard Dawkins, who is known for writing The God Delusion and being one of the four horsemen of the new atheist movement, so pretty anti-Christian guy, came out this week saying that maybe actually it's okay to be culturally Christian. So says he defended the idea that a robust Western civilization was dependent on Christian theology to thrive, after being the main reason that Britons lost their faith in God. Later in the article, it says, I must say, I should do this in a British accent.
Yeah, absolutely.
I must say, I was slightly horrified to hear that that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country, and I call myself a cultural Christian, Dawkins said. I'm not a believer, but there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. I'm already like vomiting in the back of my throat a little.
Yep.
I love hymns and Christmas carols. Oh, samesies, Richard Dawkins.
That's what it takes.
I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. And then he goes on to say, it's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that, he continues.
Nice hedge.
But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we substituted any alternative religion. That would be truly dreadful.
Dreadful.
It was so dreadful. So he's so weird. I mean, okay. So first of all, the cultural Christian thing is interesting. And, you know, Evan said before we started, the white pill writes itself here, because this idea of recognizing the value of Christianity, I guess, would be what he's saying about culturally Christian, is that we're using the sort of morality of Christianity to orient ourselves around, and that there's something helpful about that. And he makes a distinction twice in this article, at least, about Islam versus Christianity. And he says he would choose Christianity every time, which I guess is lovely for Christians to hear. But this idea that he's happy that the number of people actually believing it are going down. First of all, that's so gross. To say that about something that we believe is actually true.
Yeah.
But then it's just so selfish, because he says he likes the, you know, Christmas songs and carols, and he likes the cathedrals and the churches. Well, my guy, like, how do you think the cathedrals and parishes stay, like, from being crumbling?
Well, I'll tell you, having gone to England and Scotland a couple of weeks ago, you have to spend at least $20 to get into them to look around. Unless you go to Evensong, and then you can go in as a worshiper. But yes, they charge exorbitant amounts for you to go tour them, which is, you know, fine. I understand
they're
quite expensive.
Capitalism, baby.
But yes, there aren't people in the pew. But You know, I mean, if you take a step back,
there are not people in those pews. There are plenty of people in pews that don't have the money from the state or established churches like the ones that I used to go to.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yeah, like free churches.
Aye.
Yeah. Gotcha.
The Free Church of Scotland.
Okay. Yep. Go John Knox. This guy is definitely the example. You know, it's like wanting the milk without, you know, the cow or something, right? I mean, he wants all the benefits with none of the cost.
Well, he wants the art, right?
The aesthetics.
The cultural expressions, right? The aesthetics of Christianity.
No, I think when the Ramadan thing freaked him out, because what you saw, I mean, they made a big deal of the end of Ramadan, so you have the iftar feast or whatever, and, you know, you saw all of, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, a few months ago, that they were literally taking down the Union Jacks for pride flags, right? And now they have no celebration of Easter, but they have the end of Ramadan, you know, and celebrating that. And I think he's probably legitimately freaked out enough to be like, wait a minute, this isn't quite what I had in mind. I don't think it's just the aesthetics. I think there's a social order component to this.
I think so too. And as a scientist, I think he recognizes the fruits that have come out of Christianity, the scientific endeavors and artistic endeavors.
I don't know if he's
you don't think so?
Well enough informed. I mean, when I was in Oxford, I had a guy, one of the professors of science, his name's Alan Chapman. He's a well established. He's one of Dawkins's peers, and when Dawkins made his name, he was talking about how you can't be a scientist and be a Christian, and it just seems totally unconscious of the history.
Well, it's a delusion
of his own discipline, right? That that to us seems so obvious. But I do agree, Evan. I think in this thing, he's freaking out specifically about Islam. But it wasn't that long ago that he was catching flack from his own team for wanting to deny that there are more than two genders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is a professor of evolutionary biology, after all.
Male, female.
So
thanks for clarifying.
Yeah. He's getting flamed from the progressives that he has helped to inculcate because, after all, Richard Dawkins, despite not being a Christian, is still an upper-class, white, British, Oxford-educated male elite.
Yeah.
And is flaunting his privilege here.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, civilization, culture, whatever meta word you want to put on it, it's a fragile thing. It's built, and it only works because of voluntary, the willingness of people to voluntarily put themselves on the line to hold fast to things even when it's difficult, and to work hard generation after generation to build it. Okay, it doesn't just happen. It's not planned. You know, that's why central planning, those things fail. But civilizations where you have these core beliefs that you think are actually rooted in reality, and like, we're going to protect these things, like family or like rule of law, or, you know, what we would call the West, you know, things like due process, you know, or our jurisprudence is justice. You know,
these are
yeah.
What's that?
Cathedrals.
Yes. I mean, these are things that take decades and decades and decades and decades of sacrifice to assemble, to build, and they can be knocked down in a moment. And people like him so arrogantly come along, and they just want to knock it all down, you know, one day. And then when they sort of see the alternative, which is basically, you know, the lack of those things, the lack of law and order, the lack of jurisprudence, the lack of justice, you know, or justice by another view, it's like, oh, well, actually, how do I walk this back now? You know, I want all the cultural benefits with none of the cost.
Well, so he's seeing his society slip further and further into irrationalism.
Yes.
And he's rightly concerned about that.
He thought he could make a rational case against God, which itself is irrational.
Yeah.
So I actually feel a lot of sympathy for him. I mean, I've been... His heyday was right in the middle of his target market. I was in undergrad, and I was listening to all of this hubbub go along. And I remember several years after that, the big news story was that he had moderated his claim, and he said, well, studies do seem to show that observation does seem to decrease crime. So it could be evolutionarily advantageous that to think of somebody seeing all that you do might in fact have a positive correlation to being more moral. And so he said that at one point, and then he's starting to cry out against the irrationality of the transgender movement. Now he's crying out against the destruction of the distinctive markers of Western civilization. I don't know. This, all things being told, this has not been that long of a time, right? Like, I graduated college in 2011. It's now 2024. Back in 2011, Richard Dawkins wasn't saying, oh, cultural Christianity is nice. Mm-hmm. Right. He was on the boat with Sam Harris saying religion poisons everything.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All religion.
Right. Yes.
And so it's been, he's still not a Christian, but I mean, in 15, 20 years, who knows what Richard Dawkins is going to be.
That's true.
Well, I think that, I mean, I had two very long conversations today, one sitting out in front of the church and one over lunch with a new friend. And in both conversations, one was interesting because the guy knew me back in 2016 and because from the same outreach I did, he was in the neighborhood and he would come to lunch and things like that. And he was like, are you the same guy? He's like, because he had noticed like this, I guess, very noticeable change. And I was, I guess, a lot more upfront with what I thought. And I said, well, the world has changed.
Yeah.
Like since 2016, like so much has changed. Like we are living through a cultural revolution. Sorry to keep saying the same thing over and over again. But like in 2016, like there were battles I didn't even know existed, mm-hmm. you know, that now I feel like we have to say something about, a lot of which we talk about on this particular show. So, so I think there are a lot of people for whom the events of 2020, you know, was a kind of an eye-opening year where all of a sudden they kind of reassessed things, mm-hmm. where their lack of trust in government is booming. And we talked to in the show we previously recorded about conspiracy theories and how that can be a dangerous thing to go constantly too far in that direction. But I think a lot of people are reassessing things and they're tired of sort of being told that every aberrant view they have is a crazy conspiracy theory, which only makes them want to investigate it more.
Yeah.
And so politics plays a big role in this. But I think there are a lot of people, like not quite like Dawkins, but kind of in a similar camp where it's like, well, we tried the other thing and it's not working out. You know, mm-hmm. we talked about this in our last White Pill Radio, how you have all these stats that basically say, you know, people are unhappy and mental mm-hmm. illness and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, so it's like something is not working. And I think there are a lot of people who are like, maybe I need to give this Christianity thing another look.
Or something, some yeah. other religious substitute.
Well, but he really harps on Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a couple things come to mind. When you said the 2016 pivot, at least, it made me think of when we did several podcast episodes on deconstruction mm-hmm. and the deconstruction yep. movement. So many people, I have polled so many people and I've listened to so many podcasts and read so many books and articles about evangelicalism. And for so many people, 2016 was a big year because it was the Trump-Hillary showdown. Trump won. People were clutching their pearls everywhere. But people started to pay more attention to politics because things had taken a turn. Mm-hmm. But I also think culture war stuff was really just on the rise.
Yeah.
And so much of what we talk about in politics now is culture war stuff. And I think that's partly what this is all in reference to. Yeah. I think he recognizes there's a moral standard that Christians have that works yeah. in light of all of that. And so, I mean, he can be a moral person that recognizes morality even as an atheist, but he's heavily borrowing from, and I guess he's admitting that by saying he's a quote cultural yeah. Christian, from the Christian worldview. Like that you can be moral without Christianity, but morality exists because God exists. Yeah.
And so, these are, by the way, the claims of most presuppositional apologists that, you know, for you to construct the world that you think is good, you have to borrow from my worldview to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, so you Richard Dawkins doesn't actually possess the right presuppositions to build the world that he wants, so he steals from my worldview to do it.
Well, let me ask, instead of a presuppositional apologetics a la Bart, let me bring in Francis Schaeffer. So when we lived in Scotland, we lived on a close in Edinburgh, and we lived across the street from the great statue of David Hume, which, by the way, there are no really good atheists like David Hume anymore. I mean, David Hume was a giant.
Rephaim. Let me stop. We just recorded something else. Yes.
So on the other side of our close, our little medieval alleyway, there was a church which had closed down and had been sold to a nightclub. And the Gothic arches of the windows at the front had been painted over with a picture of the sort of Led Zeppelin Milton Falling Angel. That's number three, Milton reference.
Hey.
And that it was a nightclub and it was called Sin.
Woo! Wow.
In an abandoned church. And I want to ask Richard Dawkins, okay, the building is still there.
That's right. The cathedral.
Yep. Is that the same?
Right.
Do you want that? Or are we still missing something?
Ooh, that's really good. I like that.
Yeah.
You should be a professor. This is good stuff. Yeah.
Well, let's go to the next article.
It's connected because I heard this being referenced on a podcast that I listened to, and I went and looked it up because you know, sometimes you listen to a podcast and you think maybe they're spinning it. This is out of Axios. It seems that the research came from, we were trying to figure it out before this, maybe Household Pulse Survey.
I think they compiled some Pew references. The results of several different polls.
Either way, a survey that Axios reported on is basically talking about how often, or actually how not often, mm-hmm. people go to church. And it's kind of, it's all phrased in the negative, but the gist of it is, if you're looking at this map of the United States, the darker the color, the less often people go to church.
Because they're in spiritual darkness.
And it does coincide with political lines. I mean, it just really, a lot of the, I mean, it's not,
I mean, the Bible one Belt one. Still is relatively
the Bible
light,
Belt is, so, yeah. I mean, the if you were to put this up against a red and blue or purple map about political leanings, it would line up.
Can we flash this somewhere on
easily.
the feed?
Yeah, we need a producer for that. So yeah. If you want to produce.
I was going
to
say, this would be a great time to put a commercial in about giving us money.
So description of the map, obviously, Washington, Oregon are
Pacific Northwest
very
is very
dark.
Yes.
Maine and Vermont and all of those places are very dark. Alaska is very dark. And then kind of in the middle of all of the lighter areas, there's Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And then Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, all the south is obviously the Carolina, lightest, along with Utah for the Mormons. but what's interesting to me is this also kind of like, I don't know, does it just have to do with sunshine, right? Like Scandinavia has very low church attendance all these long days and nights.
Well, Florida, sadly, is not as, and that's the sunshine state. I know, I grew up there. They're not as light as some of the others, which is interesting because, and we used to joke living in Florida that Florida is really just New York because they all transplant down when they retire or just snowbirds coming in the winter or whatever. But there is enough of a transplantation? Mm-hmm. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Hey guys, Sarah Stone here. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a riveting podcast episode, but Theology by the Pint needs your help to continue providing these podcasts, offering our in-person events, and growing so we can bring thoughtful conversation and the hope of the gospel to a world that's increasingly walking away from church and from faith. Now that we're a 501c3 nonprofit, all donations are tax deductible. So we've crunched the numbers. And if each listener of this episode gave just $1 for each episode you listen to, we'd put a huge dent in our annual budget. So consider giving today. Go to theologybythepint.org/give and click the link to donate. Thanks so much. And now back to our show. From, you know, New York, New Jersey, some of those states that Florida has picked up a tinge of that, at least when it comes to this research. It's still solidly red politically, but
there are other polls that correspond. There was a Gallup poll that came out Wednesday before Easter, because they like to do this around Easter, you know, sort of take the pulse, you know. And so basically it was a 12% drop in 20 years. So 42% 20 years ago went to church regularly, and now it's like 30%. So that's across America. So basically a third of America right now at this moment goes to church regularly. You know, maybe like once a month, once a week, something like that. So those are pretty low numbers. So the trend is definitely going in one direction.
43% of adults would deny that religion has had a positive impact on American life.
Yeah, those are interesting too, because the question – well, this is going to get at the Christian nationalist issue.
That's where I was going to go with it.
At some point, because I think the question is – There's what is the other one where basically they feel like more than 3/4 of Americans say religion's role in public life is shrinking, and I think there was something like 57% said that was bad. Here I am making up stats on
no,
the spot.
No, it's 57% of adults say religion has a positive impact on American
above that,
life.
Half of adults tell Pew both that religion is losing influence and that this is a bad thing.
So I think anyway, we're not going to jump the gun on the Christian nationalism, which we're going to talk about at a future event and so forth. What's that?
No. You said jump the gun. Jokes over here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I do think that our relationship to, speaking of Dawkins, right? This gets to like our relationship to religion and how important it is, the way it shapes our society, the way it should shape our society, and whether it's a positive or negative thing. And I think related to what Dawkins was talking about, I think there is a certain group of people in the population that are kind of looking around and they're like, I need to give Christianity another look. I'm hopeful that's the case anyway. They may not go to a church, though. And this is my concern of what is happening, which is that people are getting, in certain areas, people are getting more conservative. They're getting more politically active. There's a big effort to get evangelicals to vote this year because like 30 million evangelicals don't even show up to vote. Jeez. Like the most basic civic service, which would radically redefine American politics if evangelicals just voted.
Wow.
But in every local state, national election, you can imagine. But I think that there are people who are like becoming more conservative, if you will, but they're still not going to church. There's still not a value seen in church, in the community. They have low regard for preachers. They have low regard for the institution.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to combat that. I don't know if it can be combated.
I wonder about, so this particular poll is about going to church.
Yeah.
And so obviously like, I guess it's Catholic and Protestant. I mean, they break it down later, but it's not as asking them, are you spiritual? Are you Christian? Are you even religious? They're asking them about church attendance. And I think there's something interesting there because I think a much greater number of people, this will get into the book you've been hyping lately, but a much bigger number of people would probably call themselves spiritual, open to spiritual things. But there is a difference. There's a marked difference between spiritual and Christian. And there's another difference between being Christian and going to church, being part of a church community. There is something, going back to what you were saying about the institutions that make life work, church is one of them. And it's not just because they wag their finger at you and tell you when you're doing something wrong, right? I mean, the community that's built there helps all of life work better. And so I'm not saying that people should go to church just for the community. I mean, start there maybe.
Be better than nothing.
Because I do think that we go to church to worship God. And to pledge our allegiance to Christ, right? To worship Him. But that is something that I think this poll is pointing to that's been lost is like, oh, I'll be spiritual at home by myself where I'm essentially worshiping myself. Because I do what I want and God and I quote God and I have a, personal relationship and we do our own thing and He doesn't care if I go to church. Well, I actually do think He cares if you go to church. We recorded a podcast. You should go back and listen with Joel Davis. I think it's called Go Back to Church or Why You Should Go Back to Church. And he's like wagging his finger in the in the thumbnail, which he probably isn't like. He's actually a super nice guy. But it was a great episode about this very thing. Like your life will be better, not to mention you'll be obedient to the God who made you and rescued you at church by worshiping at church. And then, of course, I think the world will work better. Anyway, I'm off my high horse now.
Yeah.
But yeah. This isn't just about spirituality. This is about church.
Yeah. So Tara Isabella Burton has a book called Strange Rites, and she goes through and analyzes what she calls these new religions for a godless world. And based on the statistics that she's compiled, she has a breakdown of what exactly she means by this. But the gist of it is any sort of new age, positive thinking, energy.
New thought.
New thought. If you like a large percentage of Christians say that they're Christian, but also believe in reincarnation, all of this. Yeah. So all of this congeries of various eclectic religious beliefs, she says, makes up about half of the population of the United States. About 50% of people believe in something in this
realm.
Yeah. Realm.
So wait, does that include people like us that are Christians and don't believe in all that?
That excludes Orthodox Christianity.
Okay.
This new form of whatever 50%. It's called. 50% of the country. So the age of
who is your favorite witch to follow on TikTok?
Well, there are over a million registered witches in the United States, and that is more than the number of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Is it 144?
Or members of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or Presbyterian Church in America. I heard that once, Wicca versus PCA. It's crazy.
Funny.
I'm reminded of the tagline from the commercial that they made at Dunder Mifflin in the office, which ended with limitless paper in a paperless world. So it's like,
wait a minute.
It's like, wait a minute. What did you say? Something about religious rights in a godless world? But yeah, so I think that. I guess I am hopeful, though. I am hopeful that there is an awakening. I think people are maybe at least starting to question certain narratives, institutional narratives, that are fundamentally godless, I believe. I've long said, I think every institution in America has, it's the long march through the institutions. So you look at the academy, the media, you know, Hollywood, the government itself, you know, they're essentially leftist to a one.
Now the medical world.
What's that?
Now the medical world.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so every one of these institutions is they have a profoundly godless approach, and it's becoming less and less, even the veil of neutrality is being lifted. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more people are going, oh, I see, there is a spiritual war, which is what we pre-recorded, but it'll come out after this. There is this kind of spiritual war going on, like worldviews really matter, foundations really matter. You have to build your, you know, the world on something. And so I think there are certain people, I'm hopeful that people are kind of going, okay, I need to re-examine my values here. And maybe they'll go back to church. And hopefully the church is worthy, you know, of having people revisit them.
So. And let me say this. I know, anecdotally, that there are plenty of listeners to this podcast that don't go to church. And they're Christian. Maybe they're just kind of between churches and the church shopping has turned into, I'll get to it later or whatever. But I would just really encourage you to go. Go check out some churches. Even the three churches that are represented here would love to have you visit. That would be First Lutheran, Christ the King Presbyterian, and Oak Forest Church. All three would be solid. But honestly, any of the churches that our leadership team is a part of, there are so many good churches in Houston. Go to church this Sunday. Yep. If you're listening to this.
Can I ask a spicy question?
Mm-hmm. So spicy. Let's hear it.
Do churches need to stop live streaming their services?
Ooh.
I mean, COVID's over.
Yeah. We still do it. So, I mean, I should offer defense of that. Yeah.
Do you?
Does Christ the King?
Yeah.
They don't live stream it live, but they do post it
as like a podcast.
On YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's a good argument to be made for it. I also, you know, have a 94-year-old lady that watches.
Aww.
So it's kind of like it has started this secondary thing of like, but we don't treat the online community, which is quite small anyway, but as like a campus. We don't like fundraise for it. I don't look into the camera and talk to them directly. I mean, it's
there
like
there are no red states and blue states. Oh wait, that's somebody else. Okay.
It's kind of like, well, the infrastructure's there. It's easy to do for people who can't make it. But on the other hand, when people miss church, you know, I could be like, well, you can watch it online. You know, write a sermon report and get back to me.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So
it's like book it.
Yeah.
For sermons.
We need some pastoral visitations to happen again. Come around and say, hey, we haven't seen you for a couple weeks.
Yes. Yeah. Now, that's an interesting question because I do know plenty of people that will just watch live stream and you'd for sure miss them. I mean, you're a sweet 94-year-old woman. I'm glad that she has that option. But there are plenty of able-bodied millennials in PJs. You know, watching church and I mean, during COVID, it became really easy to do that. And then you kind of stick in it. But
yeah.
Well, you guys should come to one of our churches because they're awesome.
What you got? Where's J.K. Rowling going to church these days?
J.K. Rowling.
Thank you.
Oh.
Yeah. Rowling like bowling.
Oops.
And every time I hear them talk about her, they say Rowling.
She's Scottish now, even though she's English. She moved.
So living in Edinburgh, I know the Elephant House Cafe. That's where she did a lot of writing on Harry Potter.
There you go.
Harry Potter all over Edinburgh. But J.K. Rowling, transgenderism, hate speech, and a dark day for the Scottish Enlightenment. Wow, bringing it back to David Hume. So J.K. Rowling has been a Twitter magnate for a while now, taking her stand on behalf of women's rights and against the follies of transgenderism. And she's been defending actual biological women. And now, thanks to Hamza Yousaf and the Scottish Parliament's new law against hate speech, the controversy was, can you be arrested and jailed for speaking out what it says, stirring up hatred against protected categories, including those based on transgender identity and sexual orientation. And so J.K. Rowling did a whole stream of tweets calling out various high-profile transgender people in the media and pointing out very correctly that they are actually men. And her hashtag challenge was, arrest me.
Yep.
That is so freaking bold.
Yeah, she's awesome. I mean, I got to give her a lot of credit. Yeah. And they did not. They formally had to come out and say, we find no cause.
Yeah, the BBC says, I find no fault in this man.
And the irony was that when this hate speech law past or whatever, so many people spoke against the guy saying, you're the one speaking against whites.
The number one complaint filed within the first 24 hours of this law taking into effect was the First Minister of Scotland, Hamza Youssef.
So trolling when trolling is perfected in as an art form like that, the irony. Scots are good at irony.
4,000 or something, right?
Yeah, it's
overwhelming.
Yeah, 4,000 criminal referrals, basically, saying to the police, arrest this man. He has spoken hate against people because of their race, because they're white.
And just for those that are listening that don't know what we're talking about, this, what's his name again?
Hamza Youssef.
Hamza Youssef. When he was giving a speech around this law, he just started listing all the people in government that are white, and he starts listing them by their role. White, so-and-so, white, all the people in the such-and-such, white. And he's just going on, he's listing, white, white, white. And he is not white. And so he was saying, other than me, there's no one else, people of color here. Which, I mean, it is Scotland.
I hope our audience, which, you know, we maybe have some kind of new Christians or maybe people who have thought about these issues for a long time, but what I have said to our congregation when we've talked about presuppositional apologetics or worldview issues, I say, listen for value-laden words, okay? Mm-hmm. Value-laden words, good, bad, right, wrong, hate, you know, love, whatever. All of those things have a worldview attached. You know, they're not neutral. There is no neutrality. So any value-laden word, just simply get in the habit of saying, well, what do you mean by that? So when someone says a hate crime or hate speech, hate by what standard? You know, who gets to define hate? One person's hate is another person's meaningful critique. The danger of this should be pretty obvious that this law, which is very far flung and actually quite vague all at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like what's scary is who gets to make the final decision that you have hate in your heart. It's the same reason that you should oppose hate crime. You know, certain crime is all crime is hate crime, as one would say.
Right. But that's the evidence of the hate is the crime.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's this in a similar way kind of came up when Governor Abbott kind of offered this kind of special category of anti-Semitic speeches.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, and it received criticism on the right for basically saying, wait a minute, this is we don't think that there are special categories of sin or crime, and so we don't think there's special levels of protection either, you know? And so, if you critique Israel's particular military, you know, present military campaign, you know, and there's this brouhaha that came out today about the food thing and, you know, the food providers in Gaza who were killed and Israel knew.
Really sad.
So, so you now have sort of Biden going to Netanyahu and saying, stop this. Does that mean he's anti-Semitic? If a person says something to a Jew, okay, that says, I don't like your nation's military policy, is that anti-Semitic? But that's what some people accused, for example, Candace Owens of doing. I'm not defending her. I'm just saying these are very complicated issues. And when you just throw out, you know, this is hate.
Yeah, don't be a meanie.
I'm so thankful for someone like J.K. Rowling, who has the money and the stature
rolling
mm-hmm. to to basically dare.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a reciprocity and a willingness to say, come get me.
Well, she also said if any person faces prosecution for something that they said about defending the rights of biological women, that she will also say the exact same thing and you can arrest the both of us at the same time.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you don't, then you have a case of course, in a Christian worldview, you have a case of selective prosecution, which is exactly what Donald Trump is saying about, well, wait a minute, Biden handled classified documents this way, and I handled them this way. It's selective prosecution, and that's probably why that case in Florida is going to get thrown out.
The Ashley Biden diary was recently declared to be legitimate because the Department of Justice is seeking prosecution over it.
That's
a different story.
But very interesting, yes. For how many years they said the Jill Biden, or not Jill, his daughter's diary was not legit. It was not real. It was fabricated. And now they're arresting the person who actually got it to a media source, you know, for like confiscating private whatever. Where she said that she, as a matter of fact, in this diary, took showers with her father, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So that's...
Wow. Yeah,
you hadn't heard that?
No, I had not heard that yet. Was
there's some interesting things in that diary. But, I mean, so just not making any judgments about it. I'm just saying.
It sounded judgment-laden to me. Value-laden.
Anyway, hate speech makes me nervous.
It's the same thing.
Because you're the cranky get-off-my-lawn guy.
Healthcare, equity, or any of these other things, it's such a fuzzy category, and it does create a secular code of values.
Yes.
Right, which is defined by whoever happens to be speaking the loudest at the time.
Well, speaking of speaking, the next story from Christianity Today is sort of following up on there were a number of protesters at an abortion clinic who violated the FACE Act. I can't remember off. It's a federal freedom of access
to clinic entrances.
Thank you. So basically, it's a specific law that allows people to go into, I guess maybe medical clinics, but basically abortion clinics, because there was a strategy in the mid-80s for people to sort of lock arm in arm and to make it impossible for someone to, what was the name of that movement?
Well, Right to Life did some of them.
Okay.
I mean, I remember being a kid, and our family was actually involved in some of that kind of stuff. I think we probably would look back and say we may have done things differently. Well,
there's been a whole debate about strategies of preventing abortions, you know. But one of them was that, you know, like sit-ins, like civil rights sit-ins. It was a similar strategy of like, we are going to prevent, you know, people from accessing this abortion clinic to kill the, you know, their own child. And so I still don't know how effective of a strategy it is, but my point is only to point out, and let me just read so people know what we're talking about, some of this article. A growing number of federal prosecutions and convictions of pro-life activists is prompting a new legal debate that their attorneys hope will go to the Supreme Court. This week, six pro-life activists were convicted of federal crimes in Nashville for demonstrating outside a clinic in early 2021. And so basically, you had a dozen protesters who've been convicted of federal crimes in the last year for basically blocking entrances according to the FACE Act. And so you've got, you know, basically grandmas getting, you know, multiple years in prison for, you know, having never committed a crime in their life. They committed no violence, you know, they were actually saving the life of a child, we would say. They were not harming anyone.
And were they actually blocking it? Because if memory serves, they weren't. It wasn't linking arm in arm, and it was impossible to get in, but it was...
The images I've seen, they were sitting.
Singing hymns and praying in a medical pavilion hallway outside the clinic.
Right.
A police officer testified at the trial that the protesters were peaceful, but they refused to leave. They were convicted of obstructing access to reproductive health services.
But obstructing access, in my mind, was that they made people feel uncomfortable if they were coming to kill their child.
Well, and speaking of England, it wasn't that long ago that the woman silently praying outside an abortion clinic was, and I think maybe in the UK they have like now you have to be 100 feet away.
Yeah, there are zones.
Yeah. So I only want to point out, there is just an incredible darkness around this issue. Apparently Donald Trump is making some kind of major statement on abortion today or tomorrow.
Good. It'd be nice for him to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he's going to try to find some kind of compromise. And the way that I'm hearing the pro-life community talk about this just makes my stomach sick. But I think it's because there is a huge concern that there is essentially the single female vote and even the married female vote to a degree who are going to come out in droves in November, basically because there is going to be fear-mongering about, you know, the Republican Party will not let you, you know, get an abortion. They will tell you what to do with your body. I mean, it's been said for decades. Mm-hmm. It's nothing new, but it's like especially in light of Dobbs now, you know, the Supreme Court sort of on their side, and you have states, you know, with all these restrictions. So anyway, that's a bigger topic, and one day we need to devote time to like what is the response, because there are a lot of people in the pro-life community saying, look, just do the 20-week thing.
Right.
And I'm going, have you ever seen a 20-week fetus? I mean, how can a pro-life person be saying this? It blows my mind.
Well, the troubling thing about this when I was reading through it is the reason why they get these 10, 11-year sentences is there is a civil rights conspiracy charge that is added on after that, and that some of it is also included under the RICO rubric.
Umbrella, yeah.
Yeah, which everyone is now familiar with because of Donald Trump again. Mm-hmm. It's like it's New York in the 80s all over.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so you actually don't even have to be present at the abortion clinic to face potential prosecution under RICO if you are, quote unquote, conspiring.
Right.
So if you were the admin who was like telling people what time to be there and emailing them.
If you're part of the Facebook page that...
Yeah, well, it gets even worse than that, because the Douglas Mackey case, right? Douglas Mackey, the meme guy who said in 2016 to vote for Hillary text number, right? Well, sorry. I mean, he's been, you know, convicted, I think, of 10 years in prison. He's on appeal. It may have been reduced and he's still appealing. I'm not, but he's out, he's speaking out about it right now. But, they upped the charge. It's called stacking charges. It's a prosecution, tactic, you know. So basically, but he was in like a Telegram, channel or something. And he, you know, he'd say, yeah, he gets 600 messages a day. And it's not like I read them, you know, but because he was in that group and could have read a message where people said nasty things about Hillary Clinton or what have you, and he posted a meme, they put two and two together and said, you're part of a conspiracy. And so this is, so the point is selective prosecution is, but it's necessary. Okay. We don't prosecute every crime. You know, cops will give you a warning. You know, if you're speeding, I got it, you know, but what seems to be happening is that the full weight of the government is mm-hmm. going against people who are not violent, people who are you know, have political opinions. That's why we have the First Amendment, to protect political speech, to protect controversial speech, to protect, dare I say, hate speech. That's why it exists. And so there is a conscious decision by our Department of Justice, it seems, to go after certain offenders and look the other way mm-hmm. on other offenders. Mm-hmm. So doing everything they can to protect the abortionist, but going after people who are trying to save the life of the child. Doing everything they can to literally bail out people who destroyed cities and, you know, burned them down and rioted, but going after people who link arm in arm at an abortion clinic.
So in California, correct me if I'm wrong, squatters' rights. Now the new story in New York and these other places. So New York, it's something, what, like 20 days?
30 days.
30 days. In California, it's 5 days.
Good grief.
You could have left for spring. And so I saw somebody.
Say more about that for people that don't know what you're referring to.
So I saw somebody tell this story online that and if you leave for spring break and somebody breaks into your house and lives in your house for the 5 days or 7 days that you're gone for spring break, you cannot remove them from your house by force in the state of California. You can try to go to a judge and get the judge to write an eviction notice and then maybe try to
get not do that, though, because if you say that you're evicting them, that means they're a tenant.
Yes. Oh, that's right. In which case, sometimes you have people actually paying off to the tune of thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, the people that have broken into and are living in your house.
It's insane.
Yeah, there was a guy in like Top Chef or one of the celebrity cooking shows who like did this like very successfully. And he just, I mean, LeBron James is complaining like two doors down from him in his $40 million mansion. There's a squatter who throws like parties every night. And there was a story I shared in our GroupMe that we didn't talk about. But, you know, a woman who came from Spain months after her mother died in New York to like close out on the estate or whatever. And there were squatters in her apartment and her son finds her in a duffel bag.
Her body.
You know, her body. Her and of course, they're on the loose. So, where we're at, I mean, the kind of meta picture is that I think there's a general sense that people feel like things are sort of out of control. Like there are criminals who are protected mm-hmm. and there are innocent people who are prosecuted. Mm-hmm. And that's a really bad combination. Now, maybe I have bias, you know, of what I'm seeing in the media or what's in my Twitter feed or what the media decides to pick up on. Maybe these are all like far out cases that, you know, just affect a few people here and there and I shouldn't have to worry about it at all. Maybe.
Well, first of all, everyone has bias.
Yeah.
But what's the white pill in all of this? I mean, it sounds really scary.
Leave your house for spring break? Yes.
And even when you do leave your house, you can't be on a Facebook group that had anything to do with an anti-abortion.
Well, here's my white pill.
I mean,
there's a distinction between the visible church and the invisible church in theology. And the visible church is all of the people who claim to be Christian. The invisible church is all of the people who really are, right? Because for Christianity, unlike basically any other world religion, just saying that you are a member doesn't necessarily make it so. It's a metaphysical change that happens in you. And so in various countries where Christianity is not tolerated, places like Iran or China and North Korea, and reminder, Christianity is still the most persecuted religion in the world today. Mm-hmm. The gap between the people who claim Christ and the people who are simply there in order to get membership at their country club is very small, right? Because you have no social benefit for doing so. Here in the United States, that gap between people who claim the name of Christ and people who have not has been very large because it has been of social benefit to say that. We have been built on the cultural capital of Christian civilization, as we started talking about Richard Dawkins. Mm-hmm. That has brought some positive things. It has brought some negative things. For instance, all of the immoral behavior, all of the hypocritical behavior that cultural Christians will indulge in to bring shame upon the name of Christ. Well, can we say that one good thing in having the culture turn against Christianity is that we will have fewer cultural Christians, and the people that really bear the name of Christ are going to be more visible, more visibly matching the commands that Christ gives them in order to be obedient and loving one another and in loving the world, and that Christianity will become actually more visible the smaller it is?
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's good news that this is being exposed. I mean, what I was saying earlier about how abortion will be used this election season, because I don't think the left tends to have a lot of issues to run on right now. I mean, you know, people are unsure about the economy and immigration is not popular. So and by far the voting demographic that tends to vote
single
for left,
white female,
single white women. So, you know, and so what are the issues? So the IVF issue in Alabama and the abortion issue. And to me, I keep thinking that is so dark. It is so dark to make the inhumanity of not only a conceived embryo, you know, that's in a freezer somewhere, an issue, but, you know, a woman who wants to take the life of their, I mean, you're banking all of your political aspirations on the right to kill children. Mm-hmm. That is how dark it is. And I don't know any other way to see it than that. Mm-mm. I am hopeful that people will finally wake up and say, wait a minute, like, this is what this really is coming down to. This is the great payoff at the end. I have the right to kill a kid.
Right.
That's it. That's the utopia.
And to prosecute people who tell you you shouldn't.
Yeah. And oh, but it's okay because, like, I can do all the drugs I want and I can watch all the porn I want and I can.
Not in Texas, baby.
Not in Pornhub anyway. We talked about that.
We did.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that at some point the eyes will, you know, the scales will fall off and people will be, oh, wait, this is what we stand for? You know, get behind the rhetoric. And so there is a kind of fissure happening. And I think that's a good thing.
You know what this reminds me of? C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. In the third book of C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, In That Hideous Strength, you've got this guy who's a hyper-progressive and he wants to be part of the elite. He wants to be part of the cabal. And so they take him to the reconditioning room.
Oh, boy.
And they attempt to strip away all of his organic biological presuppositions about aesthetics and morality. And so everything in the room is just a little bit wrong. Anyway, you just go read the passage for yourself, read the whole book. But what happens is they're attempting to strip away the last bits of his moral impulses towards rightness and goodness. And what happens is he has a paradoxical reaction. The idea that he enters this room and far from being overwhelmed by it, it shows him that there is, in fact, such a thing as rightness and goodness and beauty and truth. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, he does want that. And so it exposes the existence of these things that he had never otherwise acknowledged by the very fact of stripping away that final most fundamental aspect of it.
Interesting. Sounds a little like the Silver Chair.
Well,
that Lewis guy.
Same guy.
Yeah.
One or two more articles, kind of in the same vein. This, I stumbled across this, well, just today. This is from the Daily Mail. And just as a kind of bit of why I think this is important is because it seems like these two things shouldn't have anything to do with one another, but what we kind of call wokeness is it's not just like this fringe thing we can just kind of laugh at and poke fun at. Like, it's entrenched into institutions that where it seems like it doesn't belong. So, headline, UCLA Med School forced first-year students to attend, quote, structural racism course where screaming pro-Hamas speaker told them to kneel for bizarre woke prayer while pediatrician DEI boss looked on. I think Daily Mail's a tabloid, but it's not like a conservative rag, right?
It's not like a, I don't know if I'd call it a tabloid. It's not elite journalism.
Yeah.
It's like is New York Post a
tabloid? I was literally going to say, is it New York Post?
It's like New York Post. It might even be owned by the Murdochs. Anyway, a couple of articles. Actually, I do want to read a fair amount of this article because some of the details are like crazy and shocking to me. First year UCLA. Here's the point. This is a medical school. Okay, if this were like a Buddhist like yoga retreat or something like that, or some like, you know, I don't know, like Greenpeace retreat out in the wilderness, like it would make sense to me. This is a medical school where you're supposed to learn about like diagnosing diseases and treating them, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what you learn at medical school? Anyway, First year, UCLA medical students were forced to sit through a bizarre lecture by a pro-Hamas activist who made them pray to, quote, Mama Earth, while a faculty member sought to identify one student who refused to participate. Lisa Gray Garcia gave the two-hour presentation at Geffen Hall in the university's downtown campus March 27th. The lecture was a mandatory part of the structural racism and health equity class, that was all caps, structural racism and health equity class, that all future doctors must take, administered by pediatrician Lindsay Wells. Gray Garcia calls herself a poverty scola. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
I don't
I like we both look to you. What
maybe,
is
maybe it's like a scholar or
so
something?
So scala may be, because she uses a lot of puns. The first time I read it, I thought scola is like an old term for like a poet or a bard or somebody that knows lore.
Okay.
But
like a guru
that's,
or something.
So that's the word scop. So I think I don't know.
Yeah. Well, she keeps her face covered with a kafia?
A kafia, yeah. Thank the you. Palestinian scarf wrap.
Okay. Except in a few interviews, and she called Hamas October 7th attack justified. So she's like, while the rest Jeez. Of us are kind of like, wow, you know, like maybe there's like a dispute about like Israel's response or like when is enough enough?
Palestinians, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So like she's just outright saying like, Hamas, October 7th, that horrible thing, that was justified. Okay. Jeez. Students were instructed to touch the floor with their fists while she made a, quote, non-secular, end quote, prayer to, quote, Mama Earth and our ancestors. That nothing taken.
Sorry,
about that.
I'm like laughing because it sounds like a fake. This sounds like something you just typed up, you and AI.
I know. It's like.
It's not funny.
It's like.
No, it gets worse. Keep going.
Yeah. She claimed private property was a capitalist lie that killed black, brown, and houseless people who were forced to live on the streets. She grew up homeless with her single mother from the age of 11. Sounds like she probably endured quite a bit of trauma. Railed against anti-homeless campaigns during another part of the lecture she posted online. Not only are our bodies considered unclean in public, not only are our lives criminalized for being outside without access to a roof, but politricksters. Thank you. Politricksters use us for their campaigns. Actually, that's true. Actually, there's a lot of exploitation of the homeless for political ends. It's a gigantic money laundering operation. That's why they want more homeless people, not less. That's my commentary. What else? Where was the really crazy stuff?
At one point, she led students in chanting "Free, Free Palestine" as UCLA faculty, including Dr. Wells, watched in silence. During a second call for students to kneel on the floor, one refused to do so. An unidentified UCLA faculty member is said to have inquired as to the student's name. And then, so
this is like the old picture, which I guess is legit, of like everyone doing the Nazi salute, you know, and the one guy like just standing there.
Well, yeah. So this is part of the lecture. That's part of the article that's not printed here. This was a complaint that was filed by one of the Jewish student associations on campus.
Gotcha.
That they were forced to take part in a prayer that went against their religious beliefs, in favor of people that want them dead. And were feared to face consequences from the school if they did not comply.
Well, it's interesting. She says non-secular prayer. That's a quote. And so there's so many overlapping. There's so many things to talk about with this one article. But one is that if you are still of the opinion that generally speaking, that these woke movements sort of can be neutral in some way, and it's just about, you know, redistribution of, you know, filthy lucre. You know, it's just let's just reallocate money, and then once we're equal, we'll be done. Like, you're barking up the wrong tree. Mm-hmm. Like this is
a wonderful chapter in Tara Isabella Burton's book, Strange Rights.
I mean, but so this is religious. I mean, she views it as a religious crusade. Uh-huh. You know, and the UCLA does too. And so when they could
State
be learning
school,
about,
right?
You know. What's that?
Is UCLA a state school?
Yeah, I would think so.
University.
I mean,
California,
yeah. It's a public school.
And these students are being forced to take part in religious activities?
Yeah. So I'm just sort of at a loss as to why this is needed. Now, they're going to justify it by saying, well, yeah, this is medical equity, right? Because to have a fair society, we need to have equal treatment for every patient.
She called modern medicine white science.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the ones I
And
wanted.
Don't forget, she called Israel America. Clan in reference to the KKK.
Yeah.
Good grief. This is so bizarre. Sorry.
Well, she sounds unhinged. But,
yes.
You know, what goes for unhinged anymore is kind of out there. But I don't know what to say. When I'm talking about this fissure, when I'm talking about people's eyes opening, when I'm talking about people questioning institutions, this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like, there are normal people like me who are going, is my doctor going to be one of these people?
Yeah, really?
Who went to one of these schools, who like believes this stuff? I mean, because if so, I'm not comfortable going as a white person.
Just tell them you identify as something else. Tell them you identify as Palestinian.
Well, so this is the same thing in the transgender movement. If you read Lost in Translation, which is another book that I recommend, this is I don't believe it's written by a Christian. I think she's just a...
Miriam Grossman?
Miriam Grossman. I don't think she's a Christian as far as I know. I might be wrong. The medical community, like these things that are supposed to be handing down the strictures and the standards about how to treat transgender people and whatnot, they aren't really consulted, right? There's a few people that are just given free rein to write these documents, and then nobody else gets a say in it. And actually, they're kind of afraid to speak up because they can face having their license removed or being drawn up on disciplinary action from their professional communities. So you've got exactly what's happening here. You've got everybody going along with it because they're too afraid to say anything, when in fact, it's a few radicals that are leading the charge, and everybody else... They all know it's crazy. They all know it's ridiculous, but they have, or they perceive to have, no power.
Yeah. Well, as an example, you can't diagnose something properly if they're, you know, this is a South Park episode, right? You know, mm-hmm. where the teacher, what's his name, goes in and he says, "I want a, you know, hysterectomy," mm-hmm. yeah. and it's a man who, you know, who's transgender, right? So it's like you can't diagnose someone if you don't have the right medical history, you know, or you know, basic mm-hmm. facts about biology. Or, you know, understanding hormones and mm-hmm. so this, but it's like, what does Palestine have to do with any of this? You know, it's like, I don't know.
So there is a strong case to be made for a real medical equity conversation,
mm-hmm.
right? There are ways in which various communities in the United States and the rest of the world mm-hmm. do not have equal access to treatment, but. And so, like, when she's talking about the homelessness problem, that like that's good. I can see that as being appropriate. That's good to have somebody talk about how we can give these people access to healthcare in whatever way it makes sense. But yeah, like your pediatric pharmacist does not need to have an opinion on Israel and Palestine as part of their professional role.
Yeah,
right. They can have that as part of their personal beliefs, but that's not part of their training that they're paying tuition for at the pharmacy school or at the oncology school. And here at one of the flagship state institutions in the state of California, where you can't even have a Christian speaker invited on campus mm-hmm. to just speak right. to a voluntary Christian student organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is required, mandated
yeah.
For every person that goes through this medical school to take part in. And so it's religion for me, but not for thee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absurd that we ought because this we were talking about this earlier. The impulse that you make everything an ethical issue, right? I have to have an opinion on this because silence is violence. In some sense, that's valid, right? Everything is an ethical issue. You can't separate religion from politics. You mm-hmm. can't separate morality from legislation. The question is,
whose?
Yeah, whose
by what standard? Yeah. That was the last sip of beer.
Yeah.
So when you started talking about like there is a conversation to be had about medical equity, I started thinking all the time that's being wasted on this could be used talking about disaffected populations. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that I think even in the beginning of COVID, we realized that COVID affects different populations differently. And then there are all kinds of populations where you realize if you aren't knowledgeable about, say, sickle cell or mm-hmm. whatever, then you're not going to be a good doctor to those people. That could be the class that you're taking. That could be the lesson that you're taking, that you're in. But instead, you're putting your fists on the ground and praying to Mother Earth to, I don't know, bless Hamas or something.
There's a lot of evidence that says that most of medical practice is biased towards seeing man as the default.
Yeah.
Right? So the particularly female medicine and understanding female healthcare and health needs, even just basic female biology, lags behind the understanding of male biology and male-centric medicine. Why aren't we talking about that? Like, that's been, that was getting pointed out in the 1800s.
Yeah. Mm. But like, this is the whole, the problem with equity as opposed to equality is that to have this, this perfectly level result, not opportunity, but result, which is what equity really means, doesn't that mean that white people now need to get worse healthcare, you know, or males need to get worse healthcare to even it out?
Well, some people would say so.
Yeah. So I think that's a problem. That's not who I want my that's not how I want my doctor to think about these things. But I would say this too. A part of this rethinking of things, and like I mentioned 2020 earlier, well, that's because of COVID and its origins, and for some people, the cookies that they told us to take to help with that. I'm not saying the word.
Goodness.
Well, wow. I don't know what YouTube's policies are anymore. I think you can say the V word.
I wish they were cookies. That sounds delicious. I'm very hungry. Continue.
So, but in rethinking some things, you know, one of the things I came to realize is that the medical profession at large, it's not actually very concerned about your health.
No. Mm.
The whole system doesn't care about your health, which is why we have a corn-based food system and a pharmaceutical-based, you know, cure of everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not necessarily, you know, some like off in the woods, you know, hippie or whatever. I'm just saying, but like there are, you know, but we never talked during COVID about like healthy living. Like the best way to help with COVID is like lose weight, get in shape.
My plumber tried to sell me a subscription plan the other day.
Two?
Yeah.
That's plumbing?
Like, yeah. So actually I've got two different plumbers tried to offer me a monthly subscription-based service for them to do preventative maintenance or whatever. Like this is the new model.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So we –
it's cheaper to not clog your drain.
Sure.
You know?
So pay us your monthly fee along with all your other streaming services and whatnot. It's the same thing with medicine.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I worked for a few years as a cold caller for a used machinery manufacturing sales company. And the lathes, the Bridgeport lathes that they built back in the 1940s would still run and could still command a price. The CNC computer controlled machines from 2012, nobody wants. Useless.
Wow. Crazy.
Because at some point, the car manufacturers, the machinery manufacturers, everybody realized we make a lot more money selling aftermarket parts than we do the one refrigerator that your grandma bought after the war, which is still running.
My grandfather, we just got rid of a refrigerator from 1949. He died when he was 103, and it was still in the basement. It was rusty on the outside, but it still worked. That's incredible.
People used to talk about American manufacturing and how it was the golden. That's why. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
That used to be American medicine.
Right. Huh. Yeah. Well, I just think we need to rethink. And we talked about this with Meredith when we did a whole episode about food. We don't actually talk about health, and we you know, there's a pharmaceutical motivation, financial motivation to basically make a poison or a medicine. We'll call it. We'll give it a good name. The solution to everything. Related to this, real fast, then we're out of time. I know. This was an article from Boston.com. Libs of TikTok highlighted it. I follow her on Twitter, so I found it. These Massachusetts hospitals won't automatically file neglect reports for babies born with drugs in their systems. Mass General Brigham said babies born with, quote, substance exposure alone will no longer be reported to state welfare agencies unless there are other concerns the baby is abused or neglected. Now, you might be saying, why would they do that? Why would a baby be born exposed to drugs, which is dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
It could be like considered child abuse. Why would they not report it? Well, they announced on Tuesday that it's revamping its policies regarding pregnant people.
Women.
Okay. Of any sort.
With substance abuse disorders, a condition which the hospital said disproportionately affects black people and does not alone signal child abuse or neglect. So basically, because, I guess, more black people, according to their own stats, are disproportionately involved, you know, they are found to be pregnant black people, women, with some drugs in their system while they are pregnant, they're going to stop recording altogether, you know, to agencies like, I guess,
unless
CPS.
There are other factors.
Yes.
What those factors are, I would like to know.
Yeah. Well, that's
especially because it's a baby. So, I mean, like some sort of malformation. I mean, they're not going to report on something about the mom.
Yeah. Well, people can be treated with methadone for opioid use disorder, which can be prescribed during pregnancy.
But fetal alcohol syndrome can't be treated.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just an example where it's like, this is how, when we complain about sort of wokeness, we say it's an alternate worldview, it's an alternate this, it's, you know, it's like, this is, it's creeping into the institutions, not even creeping, it's like jumping, leaping into the institutions, like right where it matters, where like we can't even protect children anymore because there's this protected class, you know, of sinners, I would say, you know, people doing wrong things. And I think that's not good. We should have equal justice under the law. Isn't that the American idea?
Equal justice for all sinners, including you and me.
Including? Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Just okay. The men. I'm fine.
Anyway.
Let me say this.
Yes.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, the white pill angle. And when we say white pill, it's not always like, here's the optimistic viewpoint, right? Or here's the silver lining. Sometimes it's what ought we do in response.
Sure.
And I was sitting here thinking when we were talking about the abortion thing. There was a time in my life many years ago where I started to kind of, I never went fully to sort of the other side, but I started to be more sympathetic to the abortion cause, sort of the leftist side of things on that. Again, never going all the way, but just, I don't know, like dipping my toes in the water mm-hmm. of, well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's, and I did that partly because I was not embedded in Christian community the same way that I am now or had been before. And I kind of want to go back to the go to church thing mm-hmm. because I really do think when you purposely put yourself in a space where you're reading scripture, so God's words, right? And you're surrounded by people that are trying their best to be obedient to Christ. So, you know, God's law or his rule or his reign, it's more likely that you're going to be obedient and surrendered. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's why we have church. That's why the early church started. And so there is something that happens when you make the sacrifice of getting up early on Sunday mornings and trust. No one dislikes getting up early more than I do. But going and worshiping your creator, your rescuer, your king, that kind of realigns some of these things. It is the preventative subscription to, I tried to resist making jokes about if you guys could see his hair, this is why his plumber would say you need a subscription service because Austin has a lot of hair and that's the biggest problem with plumbing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, that preventative measure is being part of a community that realigns you and says, actually, no, that's not what Christ wants for you. He wants even better.
Here's my white pill.
Yeah.
It seems like we've had a theme running through most of this stuff today, right? You might be punished for failing to comply with the woke prayer. You
might be punished for saying hateful speech in Scotland.
You might be punished for hateful speech in Scotland. You might be punished for protesting peacefully outside of an abortion clinic. I think my white pill is, let's do it.
Yeah. Let's be persecuted.
Right? Hashtag arrest me.
Yeah.
I will not comply.
J.K. Rowling.
Right. I will not bow to the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar has put up. We've got so many brothers and sisters in the faith that have gone before us that have modeled this for us in the early church and throughout the world right now.
This is
happening right now. We have people that, as we speak, cannot meet and assemble at those churches.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are willing to sacrifice everything for the gospel, so we ought to be.
Yeah.
Amen.
Where can people find you, Austin?
Well, I am on Twitter, Dr. Austin Freeman. And I am also on campus at Houston Christian University. We have undergraduate programs. We have Master in Christian Apologetics, as we do have many other things. And we also have a brand new Doctor of Ministry program. So if you guys are interested in any of those things, it's hc.edu.
You can get a demon at... sorry. Bad joke.
You can get rid of a demon, though.
You can get a demon. Sarah, where can people find you?
By the way, if you liked Austin, you can also find him at our event on May 14th, where we're going to be talking about aliens and demons. You should come before then, but that's the one where he'll be guest speaking. Mm-hmm. People can find me anywhere. Social media, the leadership page of theologybythepint.org. Or half the time I'm here at First Lutheran. Even though it's not my church, I'm here recording this and doing things. So,
it's a beautiful church.
Cool. It is. And you can find Evan. I thought you were choking.
I'm getting over a cold, I think. Anyway, FL Houston, First Lutheran. FLHouston.org. So find us there. Anyway, but I'm Evan. So thanks for listening. Thanks you guys for coming. Until next time, we encourage you to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.